From the wet heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, a full show with investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe, the meteorite that hit Peru, and other stories of high strangeness. As you know, I've moved Linda from her once-a-month Friday night position to the last Thursday of every month, full show for Linda. And that will work out splendidly. Well, Defense Secretary Robert Gates has formally ordered the Air Force, the Navy, and Defense Logistics Agency to conduct an inventory of all U.S. nuclear weapons and nuclear weapon-related materials to make sure they're all accounted for. The order comes in the wake of the discovery last week that four nuclear warhead fuses were accidentally shipped to Taiwan in 2006. Four officers, by the way, including three colonels, were relieved of duty last year after a B-52 bomber mistakenly carried six nuclear warheads from North Dakota to Louisiana. I hope they find all that they think they have. Tens of thousands of airline passengers from around the country were thrown into turmoil Thursday when American Airlines and Delta Airlines, for a second day, grounded aircraft and canceled flights as they continue their inspections of wiring bundles on some planes. American, the nation's largest airline, canceled 132 flights of its estimated 2,300 flights scheduled for Thursday. That was about 6% of America's Thursday schedule after the Fort Worth, Texas-based airline canceled 325 flights on Wednesday. Delta has not specified the number of flights it was canceling. However, the Atlanta-based carrier said it began voluntarily reinspecting wiring on 117 MD-88 aircraft Wednesday night. American said it began its inspections after an audit of the carrier by a joint team of inspectors from the Federal Aviation Administration and the airline. The inspections focus on proper spacing between two bundles of wires in the plane's auxiliary hydraulic system, and those wires must be installed exactly according to an FAA directive. Two forensic scientists have added their names to the list of people who don't believe Sirhan Sirhan acted alone when he shot Democratic presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy in 1968. Kennedy was gunned down on June 5, 1968, at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. A gunman identified as Sirhan Sirhan was wrestled to the ground and later convicted as the man solely responsible for Kennedy's murder. But doubts lingered and conspiracy theories took root that perhaps others were involved in Kennedy's death. In a moment, we'll be talking to one of the authors of the book, An Open and Shut Case, who will tell us some incredible things. I'm looking forward to that. Big Wall Street investment companies are taking advantage of the Federal Reserve's unprecedented offer to secure emergency loans now. Those firms are averaging almost $33 billion in daily borrowing over the past week from the new lending facility, compared with $13.4 billion the previous week. The program, which began last Monday, is part of the Fed's effort to aid the financial system. I just want to know where they're getting the money. I guess they just keep printing it. Well, first it was New York, then Miami, now Michigan. Another crane accident. An accident involving a crane has closed part of a state highway in Washtenaw County in Michigan. State police say the crane, involved in a bridge repair project, partially fell through the road overpass crossing M14 on Thursday afternoon. No one was injured in that. Lots of crane accidents here. This is a heartwarming story. A 10-year-old Nebraska girl with terminal brain cancer had a simple last wish: to have her dad by her side as she lay in her deathbed. Well, it came true against all odds. J.C. Yeager's wish. Her father, Jason Yeager, who has been locked up in a South Dakota federal prison on methamphetamine charges, was allowed to see his daughter on what will be perhaps the very last time. J.C., who cannot speak, move, or eat, could sense that her father was next to her and feel his touch because she began breathing more heavily during his visit. Jason Yeager has been behind bars for almost 5 years. He's battled drug addiction, scheduled to be released to a halfway house in August. In Pennsylvania, a judge known for creative sentences that has ordered three Spanish-speaking men to learn English or go to jail. The men who face prison for criminal conspiracy to commit robbery can remain on parole if they learn to read and write English, earn their GEDs, and get full-time jobs. A shepherd is suing the Russian space agency after a 10-foot-long chunk of metal from a rocket nearly hit his outdoor toilet. Wasn't too happy about that. He's seeking ₹1 million in damages. The pioneer and global leader in Memorial Space Flights announced that it has reached an agreement with two companies to launch payloads containing human cremated remains to the surface of the moon as soon as 2009. Celestis, that's the name of the company. Charles Chafer heads up that company. Charles, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Had you on some time ago.
Great to be here again.
Tell us about this effort now to send ashes of human remains up to the moon.
Well, as you may recall, back in 1999, NASA asked us to help them honor Dr. Eugene Shoemaker, and we placed his cremated remains aboard the Lunar Prospector spacecraft, which went to the moon and ultimately made him the first person, if you will, buried on the moon. Now we're able to offer the service to anybody on the planet, Earth, that is, that steps out in a dark night, sees the moon, and thinks that's an appropriate place for memorial service. We selected two companies that we feel have an excellent chance of perhaps winning the recently announced Google Lunar X Prize, but more importantly, of making it to the surface of the moon commercially. And we're looking forward to being able to fly as early as sometime next year.
Charles, if someone wants to send the remains of their loved ones up aboard, what's it going to cost?
The cost for our lunar service is a little more expensive than our other services. It's right at $10,000, which is a little bit more than the average cost of a funeral in the U.S., but about a third of the average cost of a funeral in Japan.
And it looks like these remains will get to the moon before we get a human person back to the moon.
That's a good point. A lot of our customers actually believe that by choosing the Celestis service, they're creating more demand for commercial lunar activity, and in a very real sense, creating a lot more chances for more missions to the moon.
And once you launch, what happens? You're going to drop by parachute, or how's it going to come down to the surface of the moon, or is it just going to crash into the surface?
A little bit different than the Lunar Prospector, which did crash to the surface. These will be aboard controlled landing lunar robots, if you will, and in fact, the remains will be packed aboard those robots to help them balance their way back down to the moon, so in a very real way, contributing to the success of the mission. So they'll ride down to the planet or to the lunar surface as part of a landing mission aboard a robot.
And you know, Charles, without an atmosphere on the moon, I'm not even sure a parachute could work, would it, or would it slow it down?
I don't think it would. I think you'd have to do something like those big
retro
bags or something that they use on Mars. I think this landing will be most likely with retro rockets, as you were about to say.
So it would not break. You'd have to just do what you do with, as you said, the big bags, or just let it down.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good luck to you, Charles.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to be on your show.
The website, Celestis.com. Yeah, I don't think parachutes would work on something like that. It's not quite like Mars, where at least Mars has a small atmosphere where it could slow down a object coming in from space. A Texas man is facing charges of selling liquor without a license after he was found peddling bottles of vodka containing dead baby rattlesnakes. Apparently, that's a big thing these days, and who would want to drink that, for crying out loud? He faces misdemeanor charges for not having a liquor license, but will not be charged with the 10-inch baby snakes that he put in the bottles. In a moment, Robert Joyling joins us. We're going to talk about his work, an open and shut case about the assassination of Robert Kennedy. This is an incredible story. Robert Joyling is next on Coast to Coast AM. This hour, we're going to talk about the work in Open and Shut Case by Robert Joyling and Philip von Prague. Robert, of course, is a World War II veteran of the Pacific Theater of Operations, practiced law before the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the Eastern and Western Federal District Courts. in 1951 in the Arizona Federal District Court in 72. During the 57 years that Bob has been licensed to practice law, he spent more than 50 years in the promotion of forensic sciences. We're going to talk about his work and open and shut case. Robert, thanks for coming on the program.
You're welcome.
Now, let's go back a little bit. 1968, June 5th, Robert Kennedy gunned down at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. A person identified as Sirhan Sirhan is wrestled to the ground, later convicted as a man solely responsible for Kennedy's murder. Of course, lots of doubts lingered at the time, still do, Robert. But tell us about your work now, an open and shut case.
Well, my work began in the February following the assassination, in February of 1969. At a meeting of the annual session of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, Dr. William G. Eckert, a forensic pathologist from Wichita, Kansas, asked me to come to his room in the Drake Hotel in Chicago. And I went there at his invitation, and when I arrived in his room, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, who was the coroner medical examiner of Los Angeles, was there also. And he presented to me his autopsy protocol, which he had written following his autopsy of Senator Robert F. Kennedy, who had been shot in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles on the morning of June 5, 1968. I read the autopsy protocol, and it was probably the most thorough, most competently written autopsy protocol I had ever seen up to that time or ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Noguchi said in the autopsy protocol that the bullet that struck Senator Kennedy had entered the skull approximately one quarter of an inch away from the skull and about one inch behind the right earlobe. In addition, he found embedded in the skull black soot powder, a residue from the firing of a .22 caliber revolver. That indicated that he was correct in his determination that the gun had been held in very close proximity to the skull when the fatal bullet was fired into the brain of Senator Kennedy. In addition to that, in the autopsy protocol, you find reference to three other bullets that struck either the body of the senator or went through the upper portion of his suit coat. Two of those bullets entered his body, one coming to rest at the cervical spine, C6, and the other going out from his back, out the front of his chest, into a ceiling tile above the location and behind the location where Sirhan was standing. The other bullet that went through his suit coat at the very top portion of it did not strike his body, but it also went into the ceiling tiles above. In addition to that, it was interesting to note in the autopsy protocol that it referred to the bullets traveling from right to left at a steep angle upward. And later on, in 1975, when there was a reinvestigation of the firearms evidence,
mm-hmm.
It was found that three of the bullets that were fired that night that had entered the bodies of victims, one from Senator Kennedy, that was the neck bullet, one into the buttocks of Ira Goldstein, and one into the belly of William Wiesel, had identification characteristics that indicated these three bullets had come from the same gun. Because the four bullets that were fired into Senator Kennedy's body or clothing, had come from behind and to the right of Senator Kennedy, that meant that the other two bullets also came from that direction, or a total of six. Interestingly, Sirhan had come from the, eastern edge of the tray stacker next to the ice machines in the pantry, and had run over towards the steam tables in the middle of the room. And as he got there, his pathway was blocked by the maitre d', who was Carl Euchre. And next to Carl Euchre was Edward Menasian, and next to him there was a man by the name of Lubick. The entire distance between the steam tables and the ice machines was only 6 feet to 3 inches. These three persons blocked any possibility of Sirhan getting past their location. And when Sirhan was right in front of Carl Uecker, he was pinned against the first steam table, and he fired his gun twice. First bullet hitting Paul Schrade in the head, and Paul immediately fell unconscious on the floor. Where the second bullet went, nobody knows. There was a slight pause at that moment as Carl Uecker reached up with his left hand, grabbed the firing hand, the right hand of Sirhan, and put his right arm around the head of Sirhan and put him into a hammerlock and forced him upon the top of the steam table. Ed Minasian, in the meantime, grabbed the legs of Sirhan, and Sirhan remained on top of that steam table until he was later put into custody. He still kept on firing his gun, however. And in the process, besides hitting Paul Schrade, he hit a man by the name of Ira Goldstein in the shin, and he hit Elizabeth Evans by a ricochet bullet off the floor into her forehead. Bullet was going upward in her forehead, and therefore we know that it had to come from the floor and not from the ceiling.
Right, right.
As a result, we now had six bullets from Kennedy's position and three more from other victims, meaning there were nine fired shots just into victims. In addition to that, there were two bullet holes in the center divider between swinging doors at the very westerly edge of the pantry. And that was the doors through which the Kennedy entourage had entered into the pantry. There were also two other bullet holes in the door jamb to the left, and there was another bullet in the door jamb of the door leading to the stage. So we had an additional five bullets right there that had to be accounted for. That's 14.
And Sirhan's gun only had the capacity for eight shots, right?
That's correct. His gun was an eight-shot Ivor Johnson 22 caliber revolver. So then the question became, well, where did these shots come from? A runner for one of the TV stations with the name of Donald Schumann, in a very convoluted statement afterwards, immediately following the shooting, said that the guard had pulled his gun and fired it three times and hit the senator all three times. The investigating unit of the LAPD told him he was wrong. And after that, Vince Bugliosi and I talked to Don Schumann in 1975 at great length at his home in Simi, California. And Schumann did not deviate from the statement he had made originally. He admitted that his statement was convoluted, and it was an excited utterance following a very exciting episode that he had witnessed. But nevertheless, he said he saw the guard pull his gun, fire three times, and hit the senator all three times. He hasn't strayed from that statement.
Who was the guard, Robert?
The guard was Thane Eugene Cesar. He's presently over in the Philippines. He was a guard for the night, hired from Ace Guard Service. It was his first time he'd ever been on guard duty. And as he said afterwards, it was the last time he'll ever be on one. And later he divorced his wife and moved to the Philippines, where he's now residing.
Has anybody ever questioned him after this?
Yes,
after the fact?
There have been people who have gone over to talk to him. I never have, but I know people who have talked with him. Now, interestingly, when the guard gave a statement after the or following the incident, he said that he had gotten the powder residue in his face. I have to understand that the guard was about, behind Senator Kennedy, and Senator Kennedy was about 4 feet away from Sirhan, so at least 6 feet away from Sirhan. There is no way that any blowback from Sirhan's gun could ever get into the face of this guard.
No. Now, did the guard admit that he fired his gun?
Well, he has never admitted it, but other people have said they saw him pull his gun and fire it also. Three people
okay.
have said that.
My first thought, Robert, is did he fire it thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, somebody's firing at Senator Kennedy, and he just shot willy-nilly in all over the place? I guess
well,
that would be my first question.
Well, in fairness to him, it's not proper for us to say that we know that he intentionally shot the senator. That would not be fair to him.
Okay.
We don't
okay.
know, really, what caused them to do this. This may have been a psychiatric hysterical reaction, for that matter, such as we have seen people in combat, as you know, during wars. They shoot a gun for the first time and go crazy and just keep on shooting it.
Right. Robert, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back. I've got many more questions for you. I want you to tell us the rest of the story, and then we'll also open up, if we have time, phone calls for you. We'll be back in a moment. Our guest is Robert Joylene. He's the co-author of the incredible story, An Open and Shut Case. Coast to Coast listener and our friend, photographer Ray Ramos, has sent me a fast blast and directed me to his website. He's got a picture of the Ambassador Pantry from the hotel, but he took this in 2003, but it'll give you an idea what it looks like in an empty state. It's Ray Ramos, R-A-M-O-S, photography.com, if you want to take a look at that. I'll be back in a moment. Robert Joylin, our guest. The story, of course, of Robert Kennedy's assassination, An Open and Shut Case, on Coast to Coast AM. And Robert, wasn't there an audio recording that helps back up this theory that you're telling us about tonight?
Yes, the only known recording of the entire sequence of the assassination was captured by a Polish reporter by the name of Stanislaus Pruszynski. At the time, he was residing in Quebec, Canada, and was coming to the United States to cover the presidential campaigns of 1968. Stanislaus Pruszynski was in the Ambassador Hotel pantry at the time the shooting took place and had his recorder on, and he is the only known person and recorded the only known recording of the entire sequence. Later on, that recording was obtained from the mounted police up in Canada and taken to the FBI headquarters and copied, and a copy was kept at the FBI, and two copies were sent out to the Los Angeles Police Department. After many years, in fact, 20 years, 1968 to 1988, the Los Angeles Police Department finally sent the Pruszynski tape to the California State Archives, where it reposed for many years until my co-author, Philip Van Praagh, went there and saw that particular recording and tried to get a copy of it. It was given a very poor copy of it. And when he went back to his laboratory, he said, well, I've got to go back and listen to this more carefully. And he tried to get a recorder that was identical to the one that Pruszynski had. He finally was able to reconstruct one and go back and make the recording and then enhance it, and in the process of the enhancement, you think about, he started this in, about 2003, and he finally got it to the point where he could actually detect the shots that were being fired on that, or sounds of fire, shots being fired on that tape, and he identified 13 shots. Of the 13 shots, he also could identify that 8 of those came from the position of Sirhan, and that 5 came from the position of the person standing behind and to the right of Senator Kennedy. He didn't get any more because at that point a woman screamed a horrible scream and blotted out any possibility of hearing any more shots on that particular tape.
Robert, why at the time didn't forensic experts, law enforcement investigating this case, government officials, do anything about this? It's obvious that there was more than one gunman, and again, we're not sure if the guard was the suspect or if he even did anything on purpose, but there was more than just Sirhan involved.
Well, first of all, you have to realize that insofar as the forensic audio reconstruction of the sounds, there wasn't the equipment as sophisticated as we have presently. And neither were there people who were capable of doing this at that time. On the other hand, when it came to the physical facts, which I was more interested in, the Los Angeles Police Department, and I'm talking about the investigative detective agency part of it now, they goofed this entire investigation. For example, they had a schematic drawing of where the bullets were fired by Sirhan and where they went. And they had bullets going up into a ceiling tile to the left or behind Senator Kennedy and coming down and striking Elizabeth Evans in the forehead. Now, evidently, they just overlooked the obvious, and the obvious was that he picked up the hospital record and looked at what happened to Elizabeth Evans according to what her doctor found when he examined her. They have noticed that the bullets went upward into her forehead, not downward.
Right.
So you can't have a bullet coming from the ceiling above you and going upward. That's impossible. So in their schematic drawing right there, they made an error. They didn't rope off the area. They didn't confiscate any guns, including Sirhan's gun that evening at the crime scene. They only got that gun a couple of hours later after Rosie Greer had wrestled the gun from Sirhan, passed it off to Rayford Johnson, who about 2 hours later delivered it to the Los Angeles Police Department at Parker Center. So there were a lot of mistakes that were made. In addition to that, later when the investigating unit took the ceiling tiles down, they said they x-rayed the two tiles above and beyond the position of Sirhan. Then they destroyed the tiles so nobody could follow behind them to find out the direction of the bullets into the tiles, whether or not there were lead or antimony or other components of that bullet in the tile, and that this was gone. Over 2,400 photographs were destroyed, including photographs that had been taken by a young man by the name of Enyard, who got the front part of his pictures back and the back part of the roll of films back, but the middle part was missing. Later, he had a lawsuit against the city of Los Angeles and got a verdict of several hundred thousand dollars because they had destroyed his evidence. That kind of thing did not lend itself to people having confidence in the investigations that have been conducted by the Criminalist Division of the Los Angeles Police Department.
And also, Robert, Sirhan has continued to claim, he's in his 60s now, he's in a California state prison,
yes.
Denied parole 13 times. A friend of mine who is now dead knew Sirhan after the fact and would talk to him, and I think even visited him several times in prison. And Sirhan claimed that he was hypnotized at the time of the shooting. What a bizarre thing. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't think it's so bizarre. Both Philip Van Praagh and myself do not base our findings upon any theory of conspiratorial action, first of all. We're just basing it on factual data. But
right.
Sirhan, when arrested, had the appearance and gave the appearance of a person who was coming out of hypnotic trance. And the argument has been made that he indeed was hypnoprogrammed to do this. He has always claimed he never remembered doing any of this. And I talked to his mother at great lengths about this. I refused to go to see Sirhan in prison when I had the opportunity to do so because I've not wanted to be biased either direction in this matter. So when you look at Sirhan and you say, well, was he indeed hypnotized? They have his diary, and in his diary, there's all kinds of strange writings and fate of the order of Sirhan, for example, and their RFK must die, et cetera. And there's one name in that diary that's very interesting. It's the name of DeSalvo. DeSalvo was the name of the Boston Strangler.
Right, Albert DeSalvo.
Right, and he was represented by F. Lee Bailey. And F. Lee Bailey had DeSalvo hypnotized by a man by the name of William Jennings Bryan III, who had bragged later that to a couple of prostitutes who he kept up in Las Vegas and also in Los Angeles, that he had hypnotized Sirhan. So that's where that comes from. Now, whether it's true or not, I cannot state because it's just those are the facts, and you read them any way you want. But there is a very good potential or a very good possibility that those people who are theorists on conspiracies could read into that Sirhan was hypnoprogrammed and reacted because of that.
Where would they have found Sirhan prior to the assassination? I mean, he was obviously, you know, there working, but I mean, before that, maybe a year or two, where was the guy?
He was working as a exercise boy at a race track.
Okay.
And they also was involved in the Rosicrucians and also had delved into the area of the unknown and hypnoprogramming and so forth.
But mobsters could have found him at a racetrack, right?
They could have.
Yeah.
But there's no evidence that we know of that that happened. But and I'm sure there are going to be other authors who will be coming out with books, particularly since this is the anniversary year of the assassination, who may well have more information and may well dwell on this. So whenever I have been asked about this, I always say I do not denigrate anybody who goes into the realm of hypnoprogramming, but that is not germane to Philip Ben Prague's and my findings in our book here on the Open and Shut Case. We deal just simply with the physical facts and with the forensic science issues.
Do we know what happened to the gun that belonged to the guard?
Yes. That gun presently, as I understand, reposes at the Attorney General's office in the state of California.
Why don't we do a ballistics test with
it? Well, I understand that's being done. But
right now? Okay.
That's my understanding. But you have to understand that even if it came out negative, it doesn't change anything, because when you're doing a test on 22 caliber bullets, they are strangely very difficult to make an identification match. Only about 20 to 30% of the time would you be capable of doing so. Secondly, in this particular instance, the H&R gun which the guard had and the Ivory Johnson 22 caliber gun that Surahan had, both had the same rifling characteristics, 0.054 inches. And that is very strange. That was not known until the late 80s, early 90s. But both of these people had guns with identical rifling characteristics.
Could that have been made that way on purpose?
No.
There's no way. That was done
by the manufacturer, and you'll find those in the records of gun manufacturing, and that's how you find that.
What a case. Robert, let's take a few calls here also while we've got you. Let's go west of the Rockies. Richard, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. Always a great program. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sir, I tuned in late because I was asleep, actually, but I was there. I was one of Kennedy's workers, and I was in with the group that he was supposed to see. I'm going to make a comment now, and I'd like to get your opinion on it. We were told he was going to come down. Gene Barry was there. His camp, Kennedy's campaign manager was down there. They all told us he was going to come down. He was going to come down. And I was by the NBC camera guy, the video camera guy. And we were all waiting for him to come down. And all of a sudden, he tells me that he hears on the radio that they're whisking him out of a different entrance, and he's not going to come this way. I ended up going home thinking that he was on his way to Chicago. My thought and my question to you is, I really think this is a conspiracy.
Well, there are many people who would join you in that, but in the doing of this, the purpose that the cause or the reason for him not going to the ballroom down below is because they changed his itinerary and went through the pantry to go to the colonial room, which was at the far easterly end of the pantry. He never got there, of course, because he was shot before he got there. But he was going there to satisfy the request of the written media to talk to him before he went downstairs, instead of what they had planned before that, to take him down then to the colonial room. That's how that came about. As far as a conspiracy is concerned, there are a lot of writers who have, in fact, every writer to this day, until Phil Van Prague and I wrote our book, and they've always talked about conspiracies. We found that we didn't have to talk about conspiracies to prove that that it was impossible for Surahan to have shot Senator Kennedy, and therefore he did not shoot him, and he could not have shot him because of the fact, the physical facts just do not fit.
But you do believe he was a gunman?
Well,
he might not.
Somebody had to shoot him. Well, who it was, we don't say. The only person I know of that had a gun who was in that position was this guard.
No, but I mean, you don't doubt that Surahan was one of the two who fired guns?
Oh, no. There's no question about it. He fired twice, the first bullet hitting Paul straight in the head, and he fired a second time, and then there's a pause. And then he was put on top of the steam table, and he kept on firing another six times to the top of the steam table.
Well, you know, what we need to get to the bottom of is whether the two guns were actually used. It appears with your research that is indeed the case. What we may never know is the motive behind it, whether it was an accident or whether it truly was two gunmen who were out there to get Robert Kennedy.
That's true. And I think that's a very fair presentation that it may never be known. Because, and again, even if it was known, the question arises again, was this done as a hysteria conversion reaction, or was this done with intent? And that you never know. However, you also have to understand that all of these shots, the 14 that we know of, the 13 that Phil has captured on the
audio recordings,
tracing,
right,
that they occurred within 5.5 seconds, even in spite of that, two shots and then a pause. So only covered 5.5 seconds, the whole thing happened.
That you know what, I have fired handguns before, and even one to shoot off 6 to 8 shots, that's fast.
Yes, and in this particular instance, the oscillographic tracings show that there were two double shots. In other words, shots so close together that no one would be able to fire a gun to make those two shots occur within the milliseconds that they occurred.
Yeah, it's almost as if they were both fired at the same time.
Yeah, just a split hair off, you see. And that was a very interesting finding. And then also the other thing was that when you looked at what happened here on the delta waves of on the oscillogram, there was a difference between the gun that was an Ivor Johnson and the gun that is an H&R. And that was very interesting because the megahertz that they came in at was altogether different. And the pattern for the 5 shots was constantly the same, and the pattern for the 8 shots was constantly the same. And therefore, we knew that there were two sets of shots being fired from two different directions, directly 180 degrees opposing one to the other.
Has there ever been a ballistics test done on the guard's gun prior to what?
No, not. His gun was never taken into custody.
Amazing.
And in fact, he said immediately after the shooting, when he was questioned, that he had owned a .22 caliber gun, but that he had sold it 3 months before the incident. Later on, he changed that because we found a receipt showing that he had sold it to a guy by the name of Yoder 3 months, right to the day after the assassination, not before.
But yet 40 years later, they decide, let's test it.
Well, that's because they just got it. They haven't had it till now.
Oh, they just got it.
Yeah, the gun ended up in the hands of a man by the name of Yoder who went to Arkansas. And while he was there, some kids burglarized his home, got the gun. Then, as I understand it, when they found out that the gun was hot and what it had been involved in, they threw it into a pond. And then somebody who was an investigative journalist happened to hear about it. Without the Yoder, yes, indeed, he had bought the gun. He gave a statement to it, showed the person the receipt, and then had the pond drained and got the gun. Then that gun ended up down in Dallas, Texas, and then finally, when it was traced and they found out where it was, it's my understanding that it was then taken over and given to the Attorney General's office in the state of California, where it's now reposing. And it's supposed to be undergoing firing or test firing.
Jim,
but again,
as
they say, even if they test fire it, it comes out negative. That doesn't
right.
mean he didn't shoot it.
But if it comes out positive, then we have
then
a real story.
More evidence, right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Robert, in Open Shut Case, where do you get your book?
Well, our Open Shut Case, you go to www.anopenandshutcase, and that's spelled out, ANOPENAND. Shut, SHUTKCASE.com. Now, this is an author's pre-publication review text, and we've given this book to several people around the country to view it before we find a national publisher for it.
Well, let me tell you, you've done some great work here, you and Philip Van Prague. Good luck on that. Whatever we can do to help you, Robert, we shall do that as well. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. What an incredible story.